London dropped its dignity.
Yeah.
So has France and Germany.
Yeah.
All hands are dancing to a raggedy melody full of originality.
Sing it, though.
Hello and welcome to We Can't Remember Whose Turn It Is to Start.
Definitely yours.
Definitely mine. this is yesterday's chip paper. It is the bi-monthly, fortnightly, every 2 weeks or so podcast where we look at stories from old newspapers that we find in historical archives. So that's anything from murderers to mad scientists. I'm Jim.
And I'm Violet. And I live in London and Jim is in New York. So
but that's not integral to the structure. Before we started recording, what did you tell me an anagram of your name was? Your full name.
So my full name is Violet MacDonald. Spelled MAC, which is integral to this anagram.
Yes, that's important.
The anagram is a cold mental void.
A cold mental void, ladies and gentlemen, is what you can expect for the next 45 minutes of your life.
Maybe that's what I should introduce myself as now. I'm Jim, and I'm a cold mental void.
I am a cold
mental void. This is what I contribute to this podcast.
You can catch my band, A Cold Mental Void, 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
In the dodgy bar down the road.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've forgotten my train of thought now. Transatlantic amateur researchers. Love the old papers. And here we are again, episode 23.
If you're still with us after we wobbled through that intro, thank you very much. We really appreciate you listening. So we alternate each week on whose story it is to tell. What? And this week it is the turn of a cold mental void to tell me a story that she has found. Is a cold mental void gendered, or are you just it?
No, I'm just like, I am it, and I resemble a clown.
Oh, yeah, no. Speaking of that, have you seen that movie?
Yeah, I saw that. I went to the midnight screening.
Oh, yeah.
And you were at the, what time would it have been over there?
7 p.m.
We basically went to the film at exactly the same time.
Yeah.
On opposite sides of the globe.
That was a real treat. Anyway, this is the useless exposition. So it is the turn of Violet to tell me a story. Violet, what have you found?
I have found the story of Julia Choate Crumley.
Julia what?
Julia Choate Crumley.
Her middle name is Choad.
Choate.
Oh, right.
C-H-O-A-T-E.
Would have been a funnier story if it was Choad, but okay.
I could have changed it, but, you know, authenticity. Yeah. The headline that ran in the Vicksburg Herald went, Atlanta woman announced her marriage, went to New York to buy her trousseau, and came home with unknown corpse.
Came home with unknown corpse is the...
Yeah.
Right.
So that's the story that I have today. And I really like it because it's not a crime, per se. As in, what she does is bad, but it's not technically against the law. And there aren't any trials, and there aren't any murders, and that's a lot of what you find in historic newspapers, I think, and a lot of what we tend to cover because that's naturally what comes up.
We've covered stuff that probably should be illegal but isn't in the past.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
If you're in a court case and you're getting off on a technicality, maybe you're guilty. So she came home with a corpse.
And it's so unbelievable that... So this all happened on the 13th of November, 1915. Well, that's when the report started.
1915.
Okay. So this story is so unbelievable that World War I has just started, pretty much.
No.
And it's months?
It's 25% done.
Yeah, but it's still new. And it's not anything that the world has seen before.
True.
And yet... The Chicago Tribune still started the coverage of the story with a Shakespeare quote that said, if it were played upon a stage now, I would condemn it as an improbable fiction.
You'll notice the cold mental void right now because I'm wondering how you're linking that to one of the greatest human tragedies in history.
Because as the greatest tragedy in human history was playing.
Oh, they were shocked by this.
They were shocked by this story. The Akron Evening Times started their reports Atlanta, Georgia, November 15th. 3 years ago, Miss Julia Choate Crumley, daughter of Reverend Howard Lee Crumley, superintendent of the Baptist Orphans Home and one of the most prominent ministers in Atlanta, went to John Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore to be operated on. She was a pretty girl, a music teacher, popular socially, and apparently her mind was sane and clear as anyone's. After 3 months in Baltimore, she returned to Atlanta and told her family that her life was saved there by a physician who attended her. This next article that I found is the Chicago Tribune again, and I found that in the Chicago Tribune archives, which I haven't actually used before.
Yeah, that's I got the Euphrasia Mercier stuff last week from there, and they're open and free, and they are OCR'd, so you can get them from Google.
The search is so good.
Mm.
oh my God, I love a good search. This is what this podcast does to me, is I really appreciate a good search system.
Yeah, we're pretty heavy, hot and heavy on the old SEO.
But this article, it's just so, so wonderful. I mean, it's so beautifully written that I've just decided not to paraphrase any of it. Because anything that I say is just not the same. So pretty much everything that you hear me say from here on for the rest of this episode is written by some Wordsworth in a newspaper office in Chicago, and it's so great.
It's interesting that you position that as a positive, because what I hear is I couldn't do all the writing a script.
That's what I hear when
you say that.
No, but when you hear it, you'll understand. Like, I write for a living. I love writing. But I can't believe that someone wrote this in just a few hours before I went to press. Because it's just so delicious. But anyway.
Delicious.
So they... It's so delicious. The Chicago Tribune tells the story like this. Dr. Elaine Hensley of Quebec was born in 1912. That's not right.
No, that's completely wrong. Right, that would make right him at the top.
Three.
Yes, this baby surgeon. If he gets anything right, it is by mistake. Like, baby surgeon, you're dribbling inside this body cavity.
Dr. Elaine Hensley of Quebec was born in 1882. His birthplace was the brain of Miss Crumley, but as she was at the time in the John Hopkins Hospital for an operation.
Wait. What? His birthplace was the brain of what?
His birthplace was the brain of Miss Crumley, because
he wasn't
real.
Right. Jesus Christ, that was the... Right, okay.
But as she was at the time in the John Hopkins Hospital for an operation, Baltimore might claim his nativity. When Julia Crumley went back to Atlanta, she was in the fettle of a bride-elect, joyous, vivacious, remindful to her friends of the brilliant girl who had dominated the social whirl of the city a few years before.
Man, that's what you want. That's what you want to be. You want to dazzle society. That's the easiest life in the world.
Atlanta society came to know of Dr. Elaine Hensley. He was a noted surgeon, a remarkable young man who was making medical history and whose name was being... And I can't read the next bit. Because as much as I love the Chicago Tribune archives, some of their images are dreadful. But from that... Basically, she was telling everyone that he was a big deal.
So she has come back to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. From the hospital in Baltimore.
From the hospital of Baltimore and said that her doctor is fantastic. And they're getting married? Was that what you...
That hasn't happened yet. Yes. Bride-elect. You're listening. The next sub-headline is Flowers and Candy Galore. Flowers came from Quebec, Canada. From Baltimore came candy, and letters came from both cities, between which Dr. Hensley worked in his marvellous practice. The demand of his services always kept him within the circle of the... And again, I can't read the next bit. But though his letters breathed of the desire to be near her, duty can never give him for the trip to Atlanta.
So he can't go to Atlanta?
Yep.
He's too busy. He's just too busy.
He's writing her letters. He's sending her loads of gifts. Right, but ultimately, he's like, whenever she's like, come see me, he's like, oh, I'm working. It's like, sorry.
It's just a flat no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Telegram, no, stop.
That's a cheap telegram, to be fair.
Yeah.
I'll tell you later.
Was that your improvised name for a telegram?
What, I'll tell you
later. Yeah, you send telegrams. I send tell you laters.
Then sickness came to the aid of the lovers. Dr. Hensley was stricken ill. A letter came to Miss Crumley begging her to come to his bedside at Baltimore. The remonstrance offered by her parents was overruled, and Atlanta society buzzed that Julia Crumley had gone to her sweetheart. From Baltimore, within a few days, came a broken-hearted little letter to Miss Crumley's father, the Reverend Howard Lee Crumley, in which his daughter said that her love affair was at an end.
Oh, no.
She returned to Atlanta, and society made of her the heroine of the broken heart.
Heroine of the broken heart.
I know.
Oh, my God. In 2004, I'd have gone and seen them live. Around then,
there's so many good fans in this.
Oh, my God. A cold mental void, and then top billing heroine of a broken heart. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Oh,
they would have been the local openers for Panic at the Disco.
If all of the emo bands had just known to just look at some history, guys.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, in fairness, though, the Panic at the Disco was a real problem in the 70s.
Yeah, that's true. A short time later, letters from Canada again began to appear in the mail. She became her old, cheerful self, and the news of the reconciliation was spread. The wedding date was set for November 17th. The Atlanta paper so announced it. Miss Crumley selected her bridesmaids and her flower girls, and the Vicksburg Herald said that one of the flower girls who was announced in the papers was the 11-year-old daughter of Dr. Hensley.
Ooh. Also, dick move, getting married so close to Christmas. I mean, one payday between your wedding and Christmas.
Oh, that's true.
Don't do that to me.
She was the guest at bride's teas, parties, and showers. And 10 days ago, after having bought what Atlanta could sell for her trousseau, she set out for New York to complete it.
Can you explain to the listener what a trousseau is?
A trousseau? I would say, although I did not look this up, that it is all of the various accessories and clothing that you need to get married.
I hope it turns out to be like a sled now.
A wedding sled. It's a winter wedding.
Well, wedding sled. I've been to weddings. The wedding sled, you know. But we'll get tweets. We'll get tweets on that one, I think.
So I'm going to skip to the Washington Post now.
Another great archive, actually.
Yeah. The American papers really, I mean, I love the British newspaper archive, but there's something about the writing in American papers that is just, they make everything so fantastic.
It's more florid.
Even really dull stuff.
I also, the BNA is, the archives that we use, the BNA, the British newspaper archive, is my favourite, purely because the content goes back to 1709. You can read accounts of, like, the plague in Marseille, you know, and things like that, and that to me is just outrageously cool.
That is unreal.
But
and
if you
Captain Stewart,
worst family in history episode we did, I think it was episode 4, you know, an account of a lady being burnt at the stake in, I think it was the 1740s. That to me is incredible. But if you going directly to the archives of the American newspapers, like the Chicago Tribune and the Washington Post, there's just such great stuff in there. And it's free.
And this story, I was researching a completely different one about cults. And I'd found this cult leader that I couldn't find anywhere online. And that was why I was in the Chicago archive, because that was where he was from.
Right.
And I'd found this article about him and I was reading it. And it was only when I got to the bottom of that one that I was like, hang on, what's this headline? And then I just completely scrapped that one and I went, nope, this one's it.
That's exactly how I found 22. There was an article about the history of wife beating in the Chicago Tribune, which, as previously mentioned, luckily they were against. Anyway, Choate lady.
Back to Choate. So the Washington Post, 14th of November, 1915. Miss Crumley left Atlanta about 2 weeks ago for New York, where she said she was going to take in charge the little four-year-old daughter of her fiancé, who, she said, had been in an orphan asylum. At her request, a number of her girlfriends had made up a wardrobe of beautiful clothes for the child. Several days after arriving in New York, Miss Crumley wired her relatives that she had been joined by an uncle and aunt of Dr. Hensley, who bought the child, and that the party had planned to return home by way of Denver. The next news was a telegram from Chicago saying that Dr. Hensley had been injured in a wreck, which was followed several hours later by another message stating that he was dead and asking for $200.
What?
This money was wired to her, and with it, she secured the corpse and arranged for its shipment to Atlanta.
Whose corpse is this?
You'll find out.
I'm assuming I would file it, otherwise this would be...
a terrible episode.
This would be an example in how to leave people without closure. All right, I'll wait, I'm fine.
So back to the Chicago Tribune.
Yes.
And then Atlanta was startled by a wire from her that Dr. Hensley had been killed in a train wreck in the West and that she was going to Chicago to bring his body to Atlanta for burial.
Right.
And then it goes to the sub-headline, What the Hotel Reporter Learned. Here's what the Tribune's hotel reporter picked up at the Congress Hotel. It was on Monday, November 8th, that a slender young woman alighted from a taxi at the Congress Hotel and registered as Julia Choke Crumley of Atlanta, Georgia. She went to her room and a few minutes later came back to the desk. To the clerk on duty, she said, Maybe you can give me some information. I am engaged to be married to a man who is sick in another city. Is there any way I can be married by proxy? The clerk declared that he knew of no law that would permit of a marriage by proxy and questioned Miss Crumley as to why she did not go to the bedside of her fiancé. Oh, it is not possible for me to go to him now, and I want it done right away. Miss Crumley said no more, and the next day, she checked out.
I now know what it would sound like if Jim Belushi and Humphrey Bogart had a child. And then they
is that a good thing?
Jenny from Forrest Gump. I don't know. I think you kind of, as soon as you add Jim Belushi to Humphrey Bogart, you diminish the Bogart. But I appreciate it. I felt like I was there. I felt like I was in the Congress Hotel.
So then the report went on to say, what the City News Bureau said on November 1st. A week before, on November 1st, the City News Bureau sent out the following report. The mangled body of an unidentified man, about 35 years old and poorly dressed, was found on the tracks of the Illinois Central Railroad at East Randolph Street early yesterday. The body was found under the viaduct, and it is the opinion of the Central Police Station, who took the body to the Western Casket and Undertaking Rooms at 88 East Randolph Street, that the man had been sleeping on the viaduct and had rolled off and was run over.
Christ.
It is not known what train killed the man, as none of the crew reported the accident.
I honestly, if I was the man, I wouldn't really be that bothered which one it was. I don't care which sausage gave me food poisoning. I just have food poisoning now.
But for a train drive to just keep going.
Yeah, how are they going to see in the dark? I don't know.
I guess so, but would you not kind of feel like the, you know.
Think about what you're about to say before you get it.
How heavy a train running over a man.
I mean, maybe. If there are any train drivers listening to this, please.
Surely you must know.
How? I guess you know afterwards and you've got to clean it all off.
It's but a man.
It's a train.
Yeah, but. Okay.
If you drive a train. Well, if you drive a train and you're listening to this right now, let us know A, how many people you killed, and B, whether you knew you were doing it at the time. But it's not like hitting a cow, is it?
it is.
It's not like hitting a cow. It's like hitting a cow. I agree.
It's very, very similar to hitting a cow.
There is crossover. There is crossover.
A cow may not be as sentient as a human, but...
Yeah, they also weigh a ton and a fucking half.
Yeah, but...
You know you're hitting a cow.
I don't know. I've never driven a train.
I've never killed a cow.
Good.
Just making baseless guesses.
Good disclaimer. So, the report continued. What the police reporter discovered. The Tribune's police reporter got this contribution to the story. It was about 10 a.m. on Tuesday, November 9th, that Miss Crumley drove up in a taxi to the Western Casket and Undertaking Company, Michigan Avenue and Randolph Street. She dismissed the driver and entered, and Mr. Deneen, one of the assistants, waited on her. "I have come from the coroner's office," said Miss Crumley, "to identify the body of a man."
She said it like that, did she?
Yes.
That's how she said it.
That's what they said.
I don't think she appreciated the gravity of the situation that she was in. If she ended it with, "of a man."
That's how it went. That's what they said.
That's how it went.
That's what they told me.
Hey, no one can check.
There was only one unidentified body there, and Mr. Deneen ushered her back to the dead room. Holding the handkerchief to her mouth, she gazed at the body, and it was impressive, says Mr. Deneen. Leaning over the cold clay, Miss Crumley burst into tears. "That is he," she said. "Oh, it is terrible." She walked away weeping, and used as he is to such scenes, Mr. Deneen could scarce suppress the tremor in his voice. Returning to the body, Miss Crumley again burst into tears. "Oh, the poor dear fellow," she sobbed. "And we were to have been married this month."
What was that sentence? I support you, and I support your transition to becoming Tex Avery, but you have to tell me what you just said.
Look, that's what it sounded like. I'm reporting this true to the story.
You're a bullshit wizard, because you have no idea what it sounded like. She might have sounded like me. You have no idea.
I'll go back to the BBC RP now. "She sobbed, and we were to have been married this month."
Ah, okay.
That's what she said. It's okay, we're nearly at the end. Very close now.
No, I'm comfortable. I'm entirely comfortable in this. I'm bathing in how long this
is going. When she had composed herself, she told of the journey to Chicago from New York. On her arrival here, she said she went to the Paulus Fathers and asked their assistance in locating the body of her dead sweetheart. "I did not pay any particular attention to the woman's dress or looks," said Mr. Deneen. "All I remember is that she was well-dressed and a comely person of about 35 years of age." Which, I mean, he overshot by 7, but...
Fine.
It's not the most ridiculous thing to have happened in this episode so far, so...
No, your accent is.
When it came to choosing the casket, she said she wanted him buried decently, but at a moderate cost. She picked out a black broadcloth-covered casket and also ordered a shroud. She returned to the Congress Hotel in a taxi. After arranging for the shipment of the remains that night, she herself attended to the purchase of the railroad transportation of the body.
The purchase. Hey, come on. pizza pie.
I've got one sentence left. Give me this.
Okay, fair enough. Right.
In the evening, she met our man with the body at the railroad depot, and there our services ended.
Okay, so...
Do you need a recap?
I would appreciate cliff notes of that article, please. I was distracted by how Elmer Fudd was telling me a story.
So, she goes to the hotel. She's like, "Hey, dude at the desk, can I get married by proxy?" And he's like, no. And so she goes, okay. And she goes up to her room and she reads the paper. She finds this report about a man who's been run over by a train. She goes to where the body is being kept.
And then she falsely identifies the corpse as her lover and then steals a corpse.
Mm-hmm.
Was the guy at the front desk called like John Paul Google or something? Why was she asking him?
No, he's called Jeeves. Ask Jeeves. That's where it came from. So that's where we are now. And this body is now on its way to Atlanta.
Do we know what state the body's in?
Yeah, it's in Chicago.
Oh, God. Physical state. Do we know what physical condition the fucking body's in?
Well, it's been run over by a train.
Chicago. I mean, in fairness, that's probably quite a good analogy for Chicago at the minute. But yeah, it's been hit by a train, but there's different degrees of being hit by a train. There could be a glance. It could be a glancing blow. Or it could just go straight through your head.
Well, there's a little bit of a description later. It will become quite important at the end of this story.
Okay.
In fact, in the next few sentences, I say.
And are you doing these in Russian?
No. That's all over. It's fine. Okay.
Listen, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, and I hope the listener enjoyed it.
I hope so, too. Either that, or I will stop, basically.
Yeah, hashtag Violet stop. Hashtag Cold Mental Void stop, if that's what you
want to
happen.
We're going to have the best Twitter engagement we've ever had. And you're welcome.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Miss Crumley arrived in Atlanta on Wednesday with the casket, and it was taken to an undertaking establishment. The Manning Times said, the parents of Miss Crumley and several of her friends viewed the body. Then some questions were asked.
Wow, where's his head?
He's been run over by a train.
Is it like hitting a cow?
Is it kind of like, junk?
Do you think the driver knew?
I mean, a cow isn't as sentient as a human, is it?
That's exactly what they asked. And then she was like, what? Why did your brain go right there? It's my husband.
And then they noticed.
Was a cow. And they were like,
she was like, shit.
Come on, Chody, you are being ridiculous.
The hands of the dead man were calloused and rough, not those of a surgeon.
No. Tree surgeon, maybe.
The Reverend Mr. Crumley asked Dr. Bates Block, an alienist, which I had to Google.
And what does it mean?
It is someone who specializes in...
aliens.
The aliens invading Earth.
Yes.
This story just took a turn.
That was the working title for Men in Black.
The brain, basically. Oh. Though I looked that up about a week ago. It's kind of like a therapist / psychologist.
The combination of you saying brain, I looked it up about a week ago, and therapist / psychologist means I think you've forgotten what it means.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
But I thought it was going to be some sort of alien conspiracy story, and then I was very disappointed. So he asked an alienist to visit his daughter and talk to her. The doctor first viewed the body, then told Miss Crumley that she had deceived no one by her duplicity. Miss Crumley burst into tears and confessed the entire story.
Who's sending her sweets?
You will find out.
Sugarful.
Dear sir.
Okay.
Chicago Tribune again. With her secret on the borderland from which no secrets return, Miss Crumley's courage broke. At her home the night before the funeral was to take place, she told her family and Dr. Bates Block, a nerve specialist and alienist, that Dr. Elaine Hensley lived only in her imagination. She had borne him a figure of her dreams, but the world would ask to see a man of flesh buried before the tongues would stop wagging of the man that jilted Julia Crumley.
Okay, right. So are we saying that he existed to begin with? And then he...
No.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So Miss Crumley confessed that she had written the letters to herself and had sent the candy and presents to herself.
Oh, man.
The Manning Times said that the letter she received, she had written herself, sent to a woman whose name she read in a Canadian newspaper, to whom she paid to remail the missive to her. The candy and the flowers had come from the same source.
This is the historical equivalent of photoshopping a girlfriend into a photograph with you.
So you know what? The papers are responsible for her finding this Canadian woman. Not saying she wouldn't have found another way, but this is how she did it.
Right.
And for locating the body.
Right. So in this, so the newspapers are a character?
Yeah.
Mark newspaper.
This is another thing that I loved about this story. So the Chicago Tribune, she said that she had intended to destroy the fiction by reporting the engagement broken when she went to Baltimore, but could not bear to appear to her friends and family as a jilted woman. The darling plan of resurrecting Dr. Elaine Hensley and then burying him so that no one might doubt him then suggested itself to her. When she started north on the pretended trousseau trip, it was really to meet the ghastly bridegroom of this weird romance.
She yes-anded herself into crime.
I know.
Like, how do
that's,
I...
Oh, that's a level of improv we will never, ever achieve.
Improv is hard. Improv is hard, and it got her in trouble.
It's difficult.
Wow.
People then went to see if there were any records of Dr. Elaine Hensley ever existing, which there weren't, in the area. And then they put out personal ads saying, wanted, information regarding the relatives of a tramp, 25 years old, who was killed by an Illinois Central train in Chicago.
Who had a butterfly tattooed on his lower back.
And then they looked to see if they could find Julia Crumley, her record in the hospital that he supposedly lived at, worked at. And she had never, they had no record of her actually ever going to that hospital either.
I mean, I'm not surprised by this now. I'm not going to drop my opera glasses. Why would she go to the hospital anyway? It's miles away.
Well, that was like the whole reason she was there.
There's probably some fine Mormon doctors in Utah you could go to.
True. So the Independence Daily Reporter on the 19th of November, 1915 said, Dr. Elaine Hensley, the tatterdemalion who went to his marriage in a coffin, will be buried on Saturday, and the sexton's clods will close that strange post-mortem escapade on which he had ventured to Atlanta with the society girl, Julia Choate Crumley.
But, so they're writing about him as if he actually was this person?
Yeah, it's weird. So there was an interesting article where there's a guy, I think he's called Mr. King, he appears later, who's, Jeff Davis, sorry. I thought he was Mr. King because they call him King of the Hobos, because there was this union for...
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, it's not okay.
No, I'm fine with... Listen, it's 1915.
Really?
Yeah, it's 1915.
I guess there are worse things.
Hey, this is a king of something. What have you ever been a king of?
This is true. Mm. Not a lot.
There's a real gotcha moment there.
The Chicago accent.
Yes, that is true. You are the king of the Belushis.
So there's this guy, Jeff Davis, he's the head of this union for homeless people in Chicago. He was saying that it was really disgusting how this man's body had just been used and no one had really thought about him being an actual person.
He is absolutely right in this.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually, when you think about it, it's absolutely shocking. And then they were just kind of like, I don't know what to do with this body.
Like, this man got less respect than a fictional person.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And the way it was reported on also was, he was an object, basically.
In a way, it would have been reported as more of a tragedy if the train actually had hit a cow, because cows have monetary value. And I'm not saying that I think homeless people have no value. I'm saying that the reporting is as such.
That's how they were treated in the reports, yeah.
Yeah.
So this report continued, the proxy for Miss Crumley's phantom sweetheart is to be buried in the Arlington Cemetery with full ceremony. He thereby escapes the grave that was dug in Potter's Field for the waif killed October 21st in the Illinois Central freight yards. A mysterious person representing the Crumley family of Atlanta has made all arrangements with the Western Casket and Undertaking Company for the decent burial of the nameless bridegroom. The body of the unknown tramp was returned to Chicago from Atlanta several days ago.
To jump in on you again there, the body of the unknown tramp, I'd have seen them in 2004.
Oh, God.
I'd probably see him now.
Several days ago and taken to the Western Undertaking Company rooms where Miss Crumley had impressed it as her grim fiancé. The body will remain there until Saturday in the hope that it may be identified, and if still unclaimed, will be buried under the direction of the Crumley family's agent. The management of the company declined to say who represented the Crumley family.
So the Crumley family are paying for the burial of this unknown...
Yeah. I mean, they're very, very wealthy.
I guess least
so it's
you can
kind
do.
Of the least. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
That's the least you can do.
But
and
then...
He was never identified. They never found out who he was.
No, they Man, never did.
That is just... This guy had a hard life. Fell asleep. Was so drunk. Fell off a viaduct, got hit by a train, and then was a prop. And then was buried anonymously.
But the Washington Post printed a story about his eventual funeral, which said, Chicago, November 20th. Members of the Hobos Union today conducted the funeral of...
Also, Hobos Union. I would watch that band. This is great. This is rich content.
The funeral of Dr. Elaine Hensley, phantom bridegroom of Miss Julia
Phantom Bridegroom. Phantom Bridegroom. I would fucking watch that band. Oh my God. I'll stop.
Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah, I see. You're trying to get through it. I see.
Oh God, you're going to say it again. Jeff Davis, King of the Hobos.
Yeah.
President of the Union was the chief mourner.
Chief mourner, I probably wouldn't watch.
And they're probably like the support act that you can eat pizza while they're playing.
Yeah, I was at the bar when they were on. Yeah, that kind of thing.
The union's proposal to take him to the cemetery on a freight train with 50 bows riding the bumpers was rejected.
Riding the bumpers, I probably wouldn't go and see because I don't think they would play in any bars that I would be safe in. I will let you continue. You can continue now, I am sorry.
Thanks. There's only one sentence left of this report, so.
I hope it's awesome because I have ruined this article.
Davis said that a thimble and thread found on the body told him Hensley was a member of the union. So the only thing that identified this man was that he was a member of the Hobos Union.
Right. I mean,
and that was all they knew.
So he got the burial on the freight train with the 15 other
No,
hobos?
He didn't. That was rejected.
Oh, man.
So some people said that it was a genuine hallucination that Julia had and that she'd tried to drive it out of her head, or that it was possibly self-hypnotism rather than a calculated act. But
yeah, shit got out of
hand. I don't believe that.
Oh, you don't?
No. I think that she was a very privileged person who thought they could get away with it.
And things just got out of hand and she was like, oh, it doesn't matter, I'll fix it.
Yeah.
Right.
She did go to a mental hospital of some sort for a brief period. But I found reports from a couple of years later where she was presenting prizes at piano recitals and things like that. So everything just seemed to go back to normal for her, pretty much.
She didn't do anything illegal, though, did she really?
No. But I don't think... I mean, I don't have any evidence for this. But I don't think there was anything mentally wrong with her.
Maybe she had that affluenza that rich kid had who killed people in a drunk driving accident, and the judge gave him leniency because his brain was addled because he was so rich.
That's a ridiculous judgment.
That's not a thing that I've made up. It was referred to as affluenza. And then the kid, I can't remember the little dickhead's name, but I think he ended up getting 3 months or something. But he... Yeah, he was.
That's
spent.
The worst thing I've ever heard.
So
I'm sorry, I was too rich to realize I was doing something wrong.
And that it wasn't him. I don't think it was the defense team who said that, or maybe they did, but the judge said it. I may have misremembered every detail of that case, but it was referred to as affluenza, and he escaped prison time because he was rich, which in the US isn't that uncommon, really. It's just never. It's not often that sort of naked. But I would imagine that a rich socialite, she was never going to get any serious punishment, or she? The rich people don't have consequences. It's the same.
Yeah,
today.
And this is why I think the whole thing of it being like self-hypnotism or a hallucination, this went on for 3 years. She was getting candy and all of that stuff sent to herself for 2 years after the operation. She strung this story for a really, really long time before she decided to do something really stupid.
Do you think it might have been something like that she was actually gay and so then didn't want to tell her family but didn't want to have a relationship with a man?
Yeah, so I mean, it could have been...
Something like that.
It could have been, definitely, but...
This is a £30 solution to a £10 problem.
I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why she could have done it.
Yeah. Because I'm sure there were men queuing up around the block for...
A socialite.
However that socialite scene works. But yeah, that's a bonkers story.
Yeah. It's nuts.
Well, thank you for introducing me to the story of Chody Chumley.
You're welcome.
Whose memory I'm desecrating by referring to her repeatedly as Chody. So what I'm doing this week is a bit different. I'm being disruptive in the newspaper podcast space. So we like to read out letters.
Such anarchy.
It's total chaos here in Brooklyn. We like to read out letters and poems from old newspapers for various reasons. It's kind of a good indicator of what was important to people at the time. And also kind of shows that people haven't changed that much. They just use newspapers instead of Yelp before. They're still as mean and vindictive as they ever were. So I have more than one poem. And the reason behind that
Oh my God.
The reason behind that is this is a paper that is local to where I grew up. And they're very, very short poems. So I grew up in Manchester, in the northwest of England. And Manchester is kind of famous for rain. It rains 2/3 of the year. It's just constant rain. That's why we all have really bad haircuts, because there is just no point. It is just rain all the time. And also, for anybody listening who's like, he doesn't sound like he's from Manchester. No, I don't. I left 13 years ago. So it would be weird if I did, I think. Anyway, this is from a Lancashire Evening Post. And do you know what? I'm going to, inspired by you, I'm going to do the accent. This is kind of what my grandfather sounded like. So, Lancashire Evening Post, the 16th of May, 1957. And the article, this is a series of poems about rain, which is like an Australian having a series of poems about spiders. You know, it's just like, oh, Christ.
I thought you were going to say a series of poems about dust.
Could be dust. Could be dust. So, rain, or the lack of it. I'm not doing the accent for this, but I'll do it for the poems. In case you haven't noticed that I hadn't changed what...
God. Oh my God, that's uncanny. Oh,
that's so bang on. Rain, or the lack of it, proved a very provoking subject for our latest Woman's Page poetry competition. And that's bullshit, because two of these poems are by men.
God damn it, those men taking over everything.
Yep.
Women's pages.
Man's raining, eh?
It's raining men.
Ooh.
Hallelujah. That's where that song came from.
Thankfully, it doesn't rain men in Manchester, or we would have no buildings left. Some amateur poets chose... Where did I get to? I think I got to the word bullshit. Rain, or the lack of it, proved a very provoking subject for our latest Woman's Page poetry competition. Many readers launched into verse with their views and experiences in the rain.
It was wet.
I'm annoyed. Some amateur poets chose to write in a descriptive vein, while others looked on the lighter side, and consequently were received from very amusing verses. Here are the winning poems, which we are sure will give pleasure and in some cases amusement to other readers. In some cases.
God, it's so dry, also, isn't it?
On this page, to give you an idea of the kind of place I'm from, on this page there is a request for letters from people who eat cold meat for lunch. And there's really no context given. So... A Chorley reader, Nora, looks back ruefully on her experience of a wet day. She wins 10 shillings and sixpence for this verse. I remember a wet day. Oh gosh, what a mess. I had gone for a walk in my red georgette dress, with flower-bedecked hat, shoes and gloves all brand new. Of admiring glances, I got quite a few. Then down came the rain, a cloudburst for sure, and gone in a flash was all my allure. Which is a hard word to say in any accent. My dress clung, my hair drips, and oh, my poor hat. I don't think I've known such a wet day as that. Right. Tragedy. She was dressed nicely and she got wet.
All of her allure was just a dress.
Wow. That's deep. And then they just let men write in. So this is one of our male readers, Mr. T. Mackle.
And he said, oh, Lord, my dress.
Yeah, yeah. All my allure was gone because I got my braces wet. This is the second worst of these. And then the next one is the worst. And the two worst are both by men.
Okay, good.
So while I've chosen 66% of these poems that were written by men, they are the worst. I remember a wet day, a no play at the net day, and a sky that was cloud filled and dim. A shoes all covered in mud day, a raincoat, leggings and hood day, and the forecast was even more grim. This morning I looked at my flower beds, so parched for the rain that they lack. I looked and remembered the wet day, and I wished that the rain would come back. And that's how you know that that man isn't native to the area, because he wants rain. A native to the area knows that it's coming. And then the last one.
I don't want for nothing.
I'm happy for my flowers to die. I'm happy for it because it means I get a day where I can go and get a haircut and walk out of the barbers and then go to another place. And between the barbers and the other place, the haircut has remained roughly the same. Anyway, this is weird. This one is weird. And it's obviously, it's got some misogyny in there, of course. It's strange in many ways, but it's probably the most strange because the person who wrote it under the pseudonym Saxophone. A Bispham reader, Lord. Saxophone, is awarded a half guinea prize for this amusing verse. I remember a wet day in Blackpool last June. The ducks all said, listen, they're playing our tune. There's me with five kids and a wife with a corn. The one day I wished I'd never been born. I said, optimistic like, it's just a shower. Let's follow the crowd and go to the tower. But there as the monkeys climbed tree trunks and spars, I thought, Jack, you're on the wrong side of the bars. Right. He thinks he should be in with the monkeys. And he sang this poem Saxophone, and then in the final line gave his name as Jack. Is he called Jack Saxophone? Because if so, how can I vote for him to be president?
Why is he using the pseudonym Saxophone at all?
Exactly. I grew up in the 1990s in Manchester. I didn't come into contact with
the saxophone family.
Or a saxophone. It isn't New Orleans. This guy's in 1957. He has never seen a saxophone unless he's gone and watched it. He is not connected to that instrument. Anyway, I was incensed by him. And then I'm doing something different for the letter as well, because I apparently have zero respect for the format that we've established on this podcast. But so the newspaper, The Flag of Ireland, and this is from the 10th of November, 1888, they apparently printed responses to letters but didn't print the letter. So there's all of these orphaned responses, and I have no idea what the context was. And they're kind of great. So the first one, and they're very, very short as well. So the first one was to a guy called Hurrow, and their response was, and bear in mind, I haven't read what this guy sent in. It says, the verses are far below the average. Though they are spirited, their workmanship and ideas are trite and commonplace. And that's all it says. So they're just, come on, man. Give them a number or something. And then the second one is, we are unable to come up with the case, but if we can do, we shall communicate to Alex Wilson.
Why do they not send these directly?
I guess it's cheaper and less time consuming to set type than it is to send 15 letters. But
like, I guess so, but come on.
There is one here that I really like that just says, E.M. Kirkdale, we are very sorry to say your poetry is not as sound as your patriotism. Oh, shit. actually, my favourite, because I can guess what this person suggested. To John Jeanette in Jersey, we could not possibly do as you requested. Why not try a regular publisher? I think that person has asked them to publish his life story. That is my theory on that. And they're like, what?
His name is Jack Saxophone.
Yes.
Oh, no, it's not. It's
J. John Jameson. We are very
publish my story. Come on, it's a great one. Peter Parker will do the pictures.
The spider. And then there's just one that says, "We are very sorry, we can't give you that information." Oh, actually, no. The one that is really petulant is to FLC. The circulation varies, but it's usually very large. It would hardly be worth the trouble to find out the exact figures, which means that... But yeah, so I don't have a formal letter. That's all I have. But I just thought that it's the idea of having these floating answers out there with no actual context is just really fun. And they're so mean. Your poetry is not as sound as your patriotism. And there are two responses insulting people's creative work.
I found a lot of those the other day when I was looking for my poem, and it was like a kids' poetry competition, and they were so mean to the kids. They were like, "Yeah, no, this wasn't any good.
God damn it,
Joe, age 7." And they would literally just take them down so hard. It was hilarious, but it was also, those kids never wrote poetry again.
No.
I like that. That was cool.
Well, that is everything that I have for this week.
That's all I've got.
If you are enjoying what we're doing, please do rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your music. I've got into this pattern of talking and now I can't get out of it. Because it really helps us with algorithms that we don't really understand, but it just does such a huge amount for pushing us up the charts and getting us more listeners.
Yes. And while you're online reviewing, you can also find us at Paper Podcast on Facebook and Twitter.
You can. Good point.
Yeah, thank you.
Playing us out is Violet's Chicago accent with the international rag, with thanks to the Free Music Archive.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks.
Right. All of the. Oh no, I can't do it. I've lost it.
You haven't lost it. You haven't lost it.
All of the archives that we use for the making of this podcast can be found in the episode description.
That's actually not bad.
It's okay. It kind of came at the end there.
No,
I thought maybe I should go back and do all those articles again.
You peaked. Oh my gosh. All right. Thank you, everybody.
So you can just stop me. Why don't you stop me when it gets hard to listen to you?
Because then I'll sound like a dickhead who isn't applauding your effort.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. So. It was about 10 a.m.
It's already uncomfortable to listen to.
It doesn't even sound the same as that. No.